Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
U.S. stocks drop after a technical issue halts trading on the New York Stock Exchange. It's unclear if trading has resumed. You can turn to voanews.com. We will keep you updated. South Sudan's rebel leader says the country's civil war will continue as long as President Salva Kiir remains in power. Riek Machar spoke to reporters in Nairobi Wednesday as South Sudan's parliament formally gave President Kiir a new three-year mandate. Lawmakers had voted to extend the president's mandate back in March. Machar said that according to the Constitution, President Kiir's terms ends at midnight July 8th. South Sudan has endured 18 months of civil war between forces loyal to President Kiir and those allied to his former deputy, Machar. Media reports and eyewitnesses in northern Cameroon say at least 13 people have been killed in an attack by Boko Haram fighters. Government officials say at least three attackers were also killed in that fighting. The communications minister, Chiroma Bakari, said Boko Haram fighters attacked the village of Bordo. That village is located on the border with Nigeria's Borno state. It happened early Tuesday, and he also said that fierce fighting lasted about 5 hours. He said the bodies of three suspected Boko Haram fighters were found on Cameroonian territory. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras says he's confident of meeting an end-of-the-week final deadline that European leaders have given him to reach a bailout deal. In his speech Wednesday to the European Parliament, Prime Minister Tsipras also defended his country's reluctance to agree to tough austerity measures in exchange for financial aid. The Greek leader said any reforms must share burdens among the population, create jobs, and encourage entrepreneurship. VOA News. Iran and major international powers continue nuclear negotiations in Vienna Wednesday after blowing through a second self-imposed deadline. Negotiators have now given themselves until Friday to come up with a comprehensive deal. The original deadline was set for June 30th and then extended to July 7th. A Western diplomat in the Austrian capital said late Tuesday the talks with Iran are not open-ended and have just been extended for the last time. The envoy from the unnamed country told reporters it's difficult to see why, how we could go on any longer. An Iraqi court has sentenced to death 24 militants convicted of participating in a massacre of Iraqi army troops a year ago in Tikrit. Hundreds of military recruits were shot to death, execution style, after the Islamic State group seized a provincial capital and overran an army base. The Central Court in Baghdad Wednesday sentenced 24 militants to death by hanging for their involvement in that massacre. Four others were acquitted for lack of evidence. China's government Wednesday unveiled more measures to try to stop a 30% stock market decline in recent weeks, but the action had little impact as the securities regulator warned of panic. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
China's government ordered state-backed companies to stop selling shares and urged executives and investors to buy shares on the market. Despite the drastic action, the Shanghai Composite Index closed Wednesday's session down nearly 6%, its biggest one-day decline since 2007. During the day, it plunged as much as 8.2%. The Shenzhen Composite, tracking all the top shares on that exchange, was off nearly 3% at the close. The measure's halting trading on many stocks has made it difficult to gauge how many investors are trying to offload shares. But China's security regulator, which has pledged to shore up the market, is warning of irrational selling. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Myanmar has announced that the country's long-awaited national election will be held on November 8th. That date was confirmed Wednesday by the Union Election Commission director, according to VOA's Burmese service. The opposition National League for Democracy, headed by Aung San Suu Kyi, is expected to continue its strong performance at the polls. Hundreds of adrenaline-fueled runners sprinted Wednesday in front of six bulls during Pamplona's week-long San Fermin Festival in northern Spain. You can hear some of the revelers here. Large numbers of both local and international runners took part in the morning festivities. One man sustained serious injuries and was taken to a hospital in Pamplona, while a second man was slightly gored by a bull, according to health services. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar says the government of President Salva Kiir has become illegitimate. The former vice president said he is still willing to engage in ongoing peace talks to resolve the conflict.
That's VOA's Lenny Ruvaga reporting. Details next.
Also, an Eritrean ambassador says many migrants claiming asylum in Europe as Eritreans fleeing human rights abuses are lying about their nationality.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Nigeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar says the government of President Salva Kiir has become illegitimate. VOA's Lenny Ruvaga reports the former vice president said he is still willing to engage in ongoing peace talks to resolve the conflict.
In an interview with VOA in Nairobi on Wednesday, Machar said Mr. Kiir's mandate should end at midnight when the country's 2011 transitional constitution is set to expire. He called on the president to resign to make way for a new government.
We want people to know that the regime in Juba is illegitimate, and therefore dealing with that regime is just like dealing with a regime that has made a coup. And practically has made a coup against the people. He has usurped the power of the people to deny them the right to elect their leaders.
A political fallout between the two leaders spiraled into inter-ethnic violence in December 2013 that has left tens of thousands of people dead. The two sides have been engaged in slow-going peace talks under the mediation of the East African Regional Bloc, IGAD, but have made little headway towards a lasting deal. Machar said he is optimistic progress may be made with a new iteration of the group called IGAD Plus, which includes the African Union, the United States, and other major international actors.
We're waiting for the IGAD Plus to sit and show us the roadmap. The roadmap of how the peace process is going to continue.
Machar spoke to VOA after a news conference where he said that if Mr. Kiir will not give up power, South Sudan's people have the right to topple his regime. Government officials have accused Machar and his supporters of stalling on a peace deal. The United Nations has accused both sides of committing human rights violations during the conflict, including the forced recruitment of child soldiers. Fighting has also pushed communities to the brink of famine and displaced more than 1.5 million people within the country. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Lenny. Conflict continues to stifle South Sudan's oil sector. Asset holders have reduced their investments and potential investors are holding back due to instability. The global research and consulting firm Global Data reports oil production in South Sudan was approximately 240,000 barrels per day at the end of 2013. It is believed to have fallen to around 165 barrels per day in 2014. Matthew Derecki is the head of oil and gas research at Global Data. He says neither South Sudan's government nor rebel forces are in full control of key oil locations, and he tells me it's a factor that is negatively impacting the country's oil industry.
Prior to the conflict, the country was producing around 250,000 barrels per day, and imported production since the conflict began for the first half of 2015 has been around 160,000 barrels per day, which is mainly due to a shutdown of fields in the Unity State, which occurred when the operator ONGC Videsh, part of Indian National Oil Company, pulled out at the beginning of 2014, shortly after the conflict began. Going forward, production is expected to continue to fall through the second half of 2015 as CNPC and Petronas, both operators in the region, have also withdrawn their foreign staff.
What does this mean, then, economically for the country?
Well, South Sudan is one of the countries with the highest dependence on oil revenues, where it makes up over 90% of the government budget. So falling production doesn't bode well for the government, especially with a conflict requiring the funding to support the military. And of course, the people of Sudan, who are almost completely reliant on foreign aid at that point.
Apparently, this conflict is really impacting trade and investment. Do you see this continuing in this cycle?
Absolutely. International companies are very reluctant to invest in South Sudan due to the conflict and threat of potential sanctions based on the actions of the government and the rebels. You know, for example, ExxonMobil has already pulled out of an exploration agreement, and Total, who had intended to conduct exploration, has put that on hold. And, you know, the current operators who had existing relationships and operations in the country have pulled back from their investments in the country.
Also, how is South Sudan's dependence on Sudan's pipelines affecting the country's oil growth?
It has a major impact, as the agreement was set during a higher oil price environment as a flat fee. So since the oil price has fallen, South Sudan's revenue on a per barrel basis has plummeted. It no longer is conducive to profitable operations for them. They're also vulnerable to Sudan being their only export route, and that, of course, could expose them further. But then again, Sudan relies on those revenues just as much, or almost as much, as South Sudan relies on the oil production revenues.
Given all of these negative factors affecting South Sudan's oil industry, what is the future of the country's oil industry?
South Sudan has significant existing infrastructure and large reserves, but it doesn't have the local expertise to capitalize and monetize these natural resources. However, without political stability, IOCs aren't going to be willing to invest. And unfortunately, the situation will have to work itself out before there's a return to a constructive industry.
Matthew Jarecki is head of oil and gas research at Global Data. He spoke with me from New York City.
Eritrean Ambassador Tesfa Mikael Garatu says many migrants claiming asylum in Europe as Eritreans fleeing human rights abuses are lying about their nationality. The Eritrean diplomat also has told the Reuters news agency that the high numbers of Eritrean migrants reaching Europe this year are the result of human traffickers, not alleged human rights abuses by his government. Tesfa Mikael is the former Eritrean ambassador to the United Kingdom. The UN Refugee Agency recently reported that each month an estimated 5,000 Eritreans flee their country to avoid forced labor, torture, and other rights violations. Refugees complain that Eritrea's mandatory national service has become an open-ended sentence to forced labor for hundreds of thousands of its citizens. Many European countries have created liberal asylum policies for Eritreans based on alleged human rights abuses by the government in Asmara. Tesfa Mikael tried to persuade the UN Rights Council to terminate the work of investigators who produce the 484-page report accusing Eritrea of widespread torture, forced labor, and other human rights violations. Last week, however, the Council renewed the investigation, which could lead to referring Eritrea's leader to the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity.
A panel of experts released its assessment yesterday on the World Health Organization's response to the West Africa Ebola outbreak. It said the crisis not only exposed organizational failings in the WHO, but shortcomings in the 10-year-old international health regulations. The panel's chair called the outbreak a defining moment. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Former Oxfam Great Britain Executive Director Dame Barbara Stocking unveiled the findings of the Ebola Interim Assessment Panel.
I think you all know that a year back from now, we were really looking into the abyss, wondering how we could make sure that Ebola did not spread to the whole world.
She explained why the scale of the disease was a defining moment for the WHO and member states.
We think that there is a need for reform in the international health regulations. There is a need already for adherence to the regulations that are there, but we think they need strengthening, in part because there are few incentives for countries to declare emergencies, but also a number of countries do, in emergencies, including this one, put on trade and travel bans, which not only frighten people out of declaring, but they also make it very difficult to deliver a proper response.
The panel examined the WHO as a health emergency agency.
We know that for it to function properly for that, it will need to be changed quite a lot to be truly fit for purpose. But we think that is perfectly possible, and we are very pleased to know that the World Health Assembly agreed with us.
The panel also considered the WHO's role and cooperation with other health and humanitarian systems.
The WHO needs to make sure that it is properly interconnected with that wider humanitarian system, because we believe that if that had happened back in May, June of last year, we wouldn't have reached the position that we did.
The expert said WHO member states must also do their part, including political and financial support to the organization. The Ebola Interim Assessment Panel said while health is considered the sovereign responsibility of countries, the means to fulfill this responsibility are increasingly global. It recommended that countries should be given incentives to encourage them to notify public health risks to the WHO. It also said global health issues should be at the center of the global security agenda. It added that the World Health Organization should remain the lead agency in an emergency response, but it stressed that organizational and financial issues must be urgently addressed. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar says the government of President Salva Kiir has become illegitimate. And an Eritrean ambassador says many migrants claiming asylum in Europe as Eritreans fleeing human rights abuses are lying about their nationality. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has announced a $2.1 billion bailout of as many as 18 states that have not been able to pay their workers for more than 2 months. 2 months after his election, Mr. Buhari says states facing major financial crises would receive funds from dividends of the Natural Gas Agency and through soft loans from the central bank. Many governments of the nation's 35 states have been plagued by corruption, another crisis Mr. Buhari has promised to tackle.
In other Nigeria news, a coroner in Lagos says the preacher whose church dormitory collapsed, killing 119 last September, is criminally negligent and should be prosecuted. The coroner's report blames evangelist T.B. Joshua of the Synagogue Church of All Nations for construction of added floors to the guest house without getting building permits. 81 of the dead were from South Africa.
And media reports and eyewitnesses in northern Cameroon say at least 13 people have been killed in an attack by Boko Haram fighters on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinsica reports from Yaounde. Government officials say at least three attackers were also killed in the fighting.
Cameroon Communication Minister Issa Chiruma Bakari says Boko Haram fighters attacked the village of Bordo on the border with Nigeria's Borno State early Tuesday, and that the fierce fighting lasted about 5 hours. He says the bodies of three suspected Boko Haram fighters were found on Cameroonian territory, but that the attackers escaped to Nigeria with the bodies of several more fighters killed in the battle.
As it is, we do not have all the facts on the exact circumstances of this attack. Nevertheless, we can indicate that our defense and security forces vigorously retaliated against this barbarous attack and forced thereby the attackers to retreat.
Chiruma said Cameroon's military seized a large quantity of weapons from the attackers and destroyed their vehicles. He assured Cameroonians the military will secure the border region.
Allow me to restate to our population and the international community the relentless commitment to defend the territorial integrity of Cameroon and to protect all women and men as well as their properties.
It was the second armed attack on Cameroon since the Nigerian extremist group went on the run in early February this year, following a Chad, Cameroon and Nigeria joint military offensive against the terrorists. On March 3, Boko Haram militants took revenge on civilians in northern Cameroon, burning schools to death and razing mosques and churches. The militants group, which has aligned itself with the radical Islamic State group in the Middle East, seeks the establishment of an Islamic State in Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The World Health Organization is calling for governments to raise taxes on cigarettes and other tobacco products. A new WHO report presents strong evidence that increasing taxes is one of the best ways to help curb the global tobacco epidemic. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says raising taxes on tobacco makes the products less affordable. It says this is one of the most effective low-cost ways to stop people from smoking. It notes this measure has the added benefit of boosting the tax revenues of national coffers. WHO Department for the Prevention of Noncommunicable Diseases Director Douglas Betcher considers this a win-win policy.
Some economists early this year in a Copenhagen consensus referred to it as a phenomenal Best Buy. Not only a Best Buy, phenomenal Best Buy, because it is the most cost-effective measure to reduce the consumption and prevalence of tobacco and therefore to save lives.
Betcher says evidence from countries such as China and France shows higher prices on tobacco products led to declines in smoking prevalence and tobacco-related deaths from illnesses such as lung cancer. Data from Turkey, a middle-income country, finds a 13% reduction in smoking prevalence between 2009 and 2014, following a 50% increase in tobacco taxes. Despite such progress, the WHO reports taxation is the least implemented tobacco control measure around the world. It says only 33 countries impose taxes of more than 75% of the retail price of a packet of cigarettes. Betcher blames this on what he calls devious tactics by the tobacco industry.
The most common myth that tobacco industry promotes is that increase in tobacco taxation will lead to an increase in illicit trade in tobacco products. This has been disproven. Furthermore, illicit trade in tobacco products itself ought to be tackled. Illicit trade fuels corruption and circulation of other illicit products, as well as reducing revenue for governments.
The World Health Organization reports around 6 million people, most in developing countries, die prematurely from tobacco-related illnesses each year. This is more than all deaths from HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. The UN Health Agency predicts the number of tobacco-linked deaths will rise to more than 8 million people a year by 2030 unless strong measures are taken to control the epidemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, Well, Facebook has opened its first African office, and the social media giant says it is excited about its new status on the continent. But with African nations' reputation for not tolerating dissent on social media, could this become a complicated relationship? VOA's Anita Powell has the story.
Social media giant Facebook has solidified its online relationship with Africa in the old-fashioned way by opening its first brick-and-mortar African headquarters in Johannesburg. The move, says the company's head of public policy for Africa, Abele Okobi, is not likely to cause any sudden changes for the continent's 120 million users. Okobi told VOA News in Johannesburg the company's motives are far from complicated.
We want to learn more about Africa, and we also want to serve consumers as well as businesses across the continent. So learning more about consumers in Nigeria, learning more about consumers in South Africa, and being able to evolve our product and our platform so that it serves those consumers' needs. I'd say that's the number one thing that we would get.
The company has reached out to Africa in recent years by introducing a lighter version of its app for lower-end phones, and by debuting missed call ads that allow users to click on an ad and then receive a free call from the advertiser. Facebook officials were tight-lipped about their next move in Africa. But the move to the continent has a clear business approach, with Facebook officials touting testimonials from small business owners from around the continent who say the platform has let them flourish. But the site also plays a pivotal role in African society and politics, Okobi says.
You have NGOs who are using Facebook to bring transparency. So you have Budget in Nigeria, which is using it during the Nigerian elections to bring transparency to the electoral process. We have politicians, during the Nigerian elections, who are using it to connect directly with citizens.
That has periodically brought the company into government's crosshairs. Egyptian authorities blocked Facebook for a few days during the nation's 2011 social media-driven uprising. Even the tiny island nation of Mauritius blocked the site in 2007, after a fake account popped up, purporting to be the prime minister. And a scathing political page under the name of Baba Jukwa has drawn the ire of Zimbabwean authorities, who arrested a top journalist and his brother in 2014 on suspicion they ran that Facebook page, though both men deny the charges. It is a delicate balance, Okobi says.
That's an issue that all social media companies face and all social media companies grapple with, and it's one that we will continue to use. So we work with consumers to understand more about how they're using the platform to engage and to express themselves freely, but we also have to work directly with government to understand more about the laws that regulate media in their particular country.
But the power of Facebook is clear and pervasive. One attendee told VOA News he briefly tuned out during the Facebook event to attend to some pressing business. He was looking at pictures of his baby, he said, on Facebook. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehia Yiswuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On Straight Talk Africa. The political crisis in South Sudan is taking a heavy toll on the nation's citizens. Nearly 2 million people have been displaced due to the fighting between supporters of President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar. Tune in on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar says the government of President Salva Kiir has become illegitimate. And an Eritrean ambassador says many migrants claiming asylum in Europe as Eritreans fleeing human rights abuses are lying about their nationality. Coming up, we'll have music from Nigeria. And in our feature segment, Zimbabwe remembers Joshua Nkomo, the respected liberation leader, this month on the 16th anniversary of his death. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I hear you're beginning today with Wimbledon tennis.
Kim, my opening serve on the Sunny Side of Sports is Wimbledon tennis. Seven-time champion Roger Federer cruised into the semifinals Wednesday with a straight sets victory over Frenchman Gilles Simon. The final score from the All England Club in London, 6-3, 7-5, and 6-2. The 33-year-old Federer is bidding for his record-extending 18th Grand Slam singles title, the most by a men's player. The Swiss star last won the Wimbledon trophy in 2012 when he beat local favorite Andy Murray of Britain in four sets in the final. Murray bounced back the following year and won the Wimbledon crown. Murray also advanced to the semifinals Wednesday, beating Canada's Vasek Pospisil 6-4, 7-5, and 6-4. The field for the women's semifinals at Wimbledon is set. Top-ranked Serena Williams of the USA will take on Russia's Maria Sharapova in one semifinal, and the other will feature Garbiñe Muguruza of Spain against Agnieszka Radwanska of Poland. Serena Williams is going after her 21st Grand Slam singles title, and history favors the American star ahead of her semifinal against Sharapova. Serena has lost only twice in 19 career matches with Sharapova. Her last win against Sharapova came in the final of this year's Australian Open. Talk to us, Serena.
I love playing Maria, and I think she brings out the best in me, and I feel like I bring out the best in her. I thought we had a wonderful final in Australia. I thought it was very entertaining, and I thought she played really well. And, you know, for me, I don't really feel like I have any pressure going into this match. I feel like, you know, we both actually lost early last year, so we both are just kind of enjoying this moment, and one of us would be in the final.
American tennis star Serena Williams speaking at Wimbledon. If Serena can win her sixth Wimbledon title, she'll hold all four Grand Slam trophies simultaneously and be within one title, the U.S. Open, of a calendar year Grand Slam. The United States is off to a good start in the Gold Cup Regional Football Tournament for teams in North America, Central America, and the Caribbean. Joining us now with more details is the VOA's Toddy Abeje. Sporty greetings, Toddy.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. The USA defeated Honduras 2-1 near Dallas, Texas, in a hard-fought Group A opening match. Midfielder Clint Dempsey, who grew up in Texas, scored twice on headers in front of his home state fans. Dempsey's first goal came in the 25th minute and the other in the 64th minute. Dempsey has scored 7 goals in his Gold Cup career, which puts him in fourth place on the all-time list for the U.S. men's national soccer team. Midfielder Carlos Discua scored his first international goal in the 69th minute for Honduras. The USA has won all 13 of its Gold Cup opening matches. U.S. head coach Jurgen Klinsmann says the objective is to win the Gold Cup trophy and qualify for the 2017 FIFA Confederations Cup tournament in Russia.
We are happy to kick off the Gold Cup. We're excited about having a chance to go all the way until the end. And hopefully, you know, our big goal is to win this very difficult competition in order to qualify directly for the Confederations Cup 2017. This is our hope, this is our plan, this is our goal, and the team is very well aware of that.
Coach Klinsmann is also very well aware that the Gold Cup tournament features some very competitive teams.
This region is a very difficult region. It's very different to Europe or even to South America. So every game needs to be played. Every game, you know, starts even. As I said, you know, a few weeks ago, patience is one keyword. You know, if you're not breaking them down and not opening the account in the first half, you got to stay patient and you got to move the ball around quickly, and hopefully it opens up things. And then sooner or later, you get the goal that you need in order to get the 3 points.
After getting 3 points with the win against Honduras, the United States remains a favorite to defend its Gold Cup title. However, the Americans are not the highest-ranked team. If we look at the FIFA rankings at the start of the tournament, Costa Rica is 14th, Mexico is 23rd, and the United States is 27th. In Tuesday's other Group A match, Panama and Haiti drew 1-1 at the same Toyota Stadium, the home of Major League Soccer's FC Dallas Club. It is one of 14 stadiums being used during the Gold Cup. The biggest one is MetLife Stadium near New York City, which has a capacity of almost 83,000. The two semifinal matches will be played July 22nd at the Georgia Dome in Atlanta, Georgia, and the Gold Cup final will be played July 26th at Lincoln Financial Field in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm VOA's Toddy Abeji. Back to you, Sonny.
Thanks, Toddy. Celebrations and parades are taking place here in the United States this week for the World Cup winning U.S. women's national soccer team. The American women were welcomed to downtown Los Angeles by a crowd of several thousand cheering fans at a rally. Veteran striker Abby Wambach joyously lifted the World Cup trophy while leading the roaring crowd in chants of, "I believe that we just won." The U.S. women won their record third World Cup title Sunday in Vancouver, Canada, where they beat defending champion Japan 5-2 in the final. The U.S. team will be touring different parts of the United States on its victory tour. The next stop is New York City on Friday. Our African football guru David Legg has been looking at the recent results in qualifying for the 2016 African Nations Championship, which will be hosted by Rwanda. The qualifying competition is for players based in Africa, and the matches are held on a regional basis. This evening, David turns his attention to the East Zone and a draw in Uganda's capital.
The first result, Uganda 1, Tanzania 1. Boko, after 58 minutes from the penalty spot for the Tanzanians, Kizito equalizing 6 minutes from time. This was a surprise result, Sonny, in the sense that Uganda won the first match in Tanzania 3-0. So I think it was fair to assume that the Ugandans would also win the return match in Kampala. But it was not to be. A much improved performance by the Tanzanians, ending that awful run of 6 consecutive defeats by their senior national team. Pretty predictable result from Bujumbura, Burundi 2, Djibouti 0. Burundi qualified 4-1 on aggregate. And then I'm afraid more disappointment for all our Kenyan listeners. In Nairobi, it was Kenya 0, Ethiopia 0. Ethiopia win 2-0 on aggregate. And really, the Kenyans must be kicking themselves quite literally. Because in each leg, both in Ethiopia and in Kenya, they had a penalty. They failed to convert either. And if they had converted those two penalties, they would have won the tie. Bobby Williamson, the Scottish coach of the Kenyans, I watched his post-match interview in Nairobi, and he just kept shaking his head, and he looked like a man who just couldn't believe what he was seeing. The Kenyans, Sonny, were really woeful when it came to set pieces. They continually over-hit corner kicks, and many of their free kicks lacked real power and accuracy. There's no doubt in my mind, having watched the game, that the Kenyans had ample opportunities to have won the second match and to have won the tie, but they didn't take their chances. And now for the fourth consecutive African Nations Championship qualifying competition, the Kenyans have failed to make it to the finals. On to the South Zone in Moroni. Comores 0, Zimbabwe 0. Zimbabwe win 2-0 on aggregate. But an interesting tale behind this match. Before that game, Zimbabwe held an amazing record of having won every away match in three previous qualifying competitions for CHAN. Truly remarkable performance. 6 matches away, 6 victories. So that run has come to an end, but nevertheless, Zimbabwe will be happy that they're through to the next round. Surprise in Gaborone, Botswana won, the Sotho won. The Sotho win on the away goals. Now, Botswana were the seeded team, and after drawing 0-0 in Lesotho, they must have felt that their chances were good of reaching the first round proper. But it was Lesotho who went ahead 9 minutes from time. Botswana did manage an equaliser, but that second goal that they needed to scrape through proved elusive. In Lusaka, another tingler. Nervous times indeed for the Zambians. Zambia 2, Namibia 1. 3-3 on aggregate. The match went to a penalty shootout, and the Zambians won 6-5. So a real scare there for Zambia, who qualified for the first CHAN in 2009, but did not qualify in 2011 or 2014. In Victoria, I'm afraid, more bad news for Seychelles. Seychelles 0, Mozambique 4. That is 9-1 on aggregate, the Mozambicans winning the first leg 5-1. And by doing this, Sonny, the Mozambicans created not one, but 2 CHAN records. 9-1 is a record winning margin for a qualifying match, and 4-0 away from home is a record victory margin, the previous one being Zimbabwe winning 3-0 in Mauritius. Talking of Mauritius, they went down 2-0 at home to South Africa. No surprise there. The South Africans were well on top, but it took them until midway through the second half before Masango scored. And a lovely late goal from defender Letla Pika completed a 2-0 victory for the South Africans and 5-0 on aggregate. And finally in Luanda, Angola 2, Swaziland 0, 4-2 to the Angolans on aggregate. And the star of the Angolans in the second leg was Gelson. He scored in each half. So all those teams true, Sonny, to the first round proper, and that will be held during October.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Finally, in more African football news, our friend in Lagos, Segun Dot on the spot at Adeyemi, reports former Super Eagles captain Sunday Olise is being seriously considered as Nigeria's next head coach. Segun says Olise could be named as early as Friday to replace the fired Stephen Keshi. The 40-year-old Olise has little managerial experience. Segun says he's been working lately as a sports analyst on the South African satellite TV channel Supersport. Segun adds that Olise has a good rating among the many football lovers in Nigeria, perhaps because of his adjudged good leadership role when he captained the Super Eagles. In Segun's words, he's considered straightforward and capable. We'll stand by to see whether Sunday Olise is the next head coach of Nigeria's Super Eagles. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny and Toddy. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Zimbabwe remembers Joshua Nkomo, the respected liberation leader, this month on the 16th anniversary of his death. And next, we focus on a young man from South Sudan who earned an economic degree at one of America's most renowned universities. But first, some music. Here is Sonny Enye of Nigeria with Finally.
Side by side today as family. Say.
Sunny Nagy of Nigeria with Finally.
Well, Zimbabwe remembers respected liberation leader Joshua Nkomo this month on the 16th anniversary of his death. The Indibele politician was leader of the ZAPU, the Zimbabwe African People's Party. In the 1970s, he fought alongside Robert Mugabe, the head of ZANU, the now ruling party, to free the country from all-white rule. In the nation's first democratic election, he lost the presidency to Mr. Mugabe. His son, Michael Simbangaziwe Nkomo, recently spoke to VOA. He said most Zimbabwean leaders are too self-centered, a situation that has led to the current social, economic, and political problems in the country. Reporter Tarai Shava reports from Bulawayo.
Simbangaziwe Nkomo says his father was a selfless man. We had time even for ordinary people. He says despite having little material possessions, Father Zimbabwe, as the late nationalist was popularly known, would always try to help people in every way possible. He says such humility and generosity are lacking in most of today's leaders, noting that their self-centeredness is partly to blame for some of the problems the country is currently facing.
The crop of leaders we have today, they like money. They are for themselves. They are not for the people. Dala went out of his way to do things for the people. You didn't need an appointment to see Umtala. Ordinary people, anybody could come and knock at the door any time of the day, and he would welcome them and help them whichever way he could. But with the current crop of leadership, they don't answer telephones. I've tried it myself to try and talk to some leaders here. They don't even answer their telephones now. How do you expect to work for the people if you can't answer telephones? I'm sure wherever my father is, he must be shaking his head, wondering what kind of leadership we have.
Swangilizwe Nkomo says, although it has been 16 years since his father's death, it still feels like yesterday as the nationalist's name gets constant mention in the media. Nkomo says rather than being sorrowful on such a day, his family normally celebrates the late vice president's death with joy and inspiration from his monumental achievements.
He brings hope, he brings vigor into my life personally to say, something has to happen to better our lives, because the old man was committed to this nation so much that you can't help but feel good about it. We don't have time to cry, as it were. You can't cry over that we lost, such a good man.
Nkomo equally praises President Robert Mugabe for being able to unite former Liberation Parties, PF ZAPU, that was led by his father, and ZANU PF. Some Bulawayo residents still vividly remember the late nationalist, with some of them saying Nkomo left the nation a proud legacy. Gift Mtizwa says to him, the late vice president's most important achievement was that of being a peacemaker and a nation builder, a view shared by another resident who only wants to be identified as Stembile. Stembile says, although she was rather young when Nkomo died, she has over the years realized the huge role he played in the history of the nation.
He was a peacemaker. He managed to unite the people of Matabeleland and Mashonaland. He was a unifier. He managed to unify people of different ethnic groups. I think if he was still around, there was going to be change. Our economy was going to be in a better state.
Chairman Max Mkandla of the Zimbabwe Liberators Peace Forum echoes the same sentiments, saying Nkomo was passionate about empowering people and believed that it was important for indigenous blacks to own their land. While agreeing that the land reform program, which started a few years ago in Zimbabwe, has helped towards the realization of this goal, Mkandla laments the way in which it was carried out by the ruling ZANU-PF party, which resulted in some people getting multiple farms. Former war veterans leader Jabulani Sibanda, who was recently expelled from ZANU-PF for allegedly teaming up with some senior officials to try to remove Mr. Mugabe from power, says if Nkomo was alive today, he would be sad about what is happening in the country, where corruption and greed are the order of the day.
What we have in our country now, if Nkomo was here, we'll be very much disappointed. You find one person who is running a concession, animal concession, is the same person who has got a ranch, is the same person who has got a cropping farm. He has got various industries in the utilization of land. We cannot have that. If a person wants to do cropping, he must do cropping and have a few cattle there for just his home purposes. But it should be known that this guy is cropping. It should be one family, one farm. One family, one piece of land. It's not only one man, one farm. It should be standardized size of farm.
from Kandla, Ngomo as a statesman who was broad-minded and would not have approved of the situation in which Zimbabwe has made enemies with other countries. He says Zimbabwe needs to mend its relations with the international community, as this would help revive the economy. And he believes that this is exactly what Ngomo fought for in the liberation struggle of the 1970s.
If you are a leader, you should embrace all countries so that they invest in the country, and then the people definitely will find the jobs and then to revive our economy.
A march known as the Joshua Nkabuko Legacy Walk, which is often held as part of commemorations to mark the death of the late Nkomo, has been moved to a date yet to be set by the organizers of the event. The late vice president remains loved by many who still cherish the moments they used to call him Chibwe Chitedza, Umdala Wetu, and Father Zimbabwe. Reporting from Lawayo, this is Taurai Shava.
A young man from South Sudan earned an economics degree at one of America's most renowned universities. Now, instead of working for the World Bank, he is planning to be a farmer in Kenya. Ian Bior reports from Washington.
Meet Paul Lorem. He's a 24-year-old from South Sudan who grew up in Kenya's Kakuma refugee camp. Lorem's parents died in Sudan's 22-year civil war. He grew up without running water, electricity, or school supplies, and now is a recent graduate of Yale University in the United States with a degree in economics.
A lot of my friends have been making fun of me that you went to Yale and you're trying to go and become a farmer.
Yes, you heard him correctly. Lorem wants to take his economics degree from one of the world's top universities to become a farmer. He plans to return to East Africa to start a new venture called Tanuru Farms, which will focus on modernizing the farming techniques of three main crops grown in Kenya. All joking aside, Lorem knows he faces many challenges, including East Africa's antiquated farming methods, a lack of infrastructure, and political instability. But he's determined to see it through.
A Yale degree gives you a tremendous opportunity to network with people from all corners of the world, and it would give you an opportunity to see actually farming can be such a transformational thing.
Lorem says if he had his way, he would go back to South Sudan and help build the country. But that's difficult right now because of the ongoing conflict. Lorem says he hopes to one day expand Tanuru Farms into South Sudan to help local farmers and other young people use the resources the country already has.
Unfortunately, for our country, with the current war and all the issues that we've had, the youth in our country have never been able to sort of acquire the skills and the necessary educations or experience that would enable them to take hold of the reins of power in the near future.
Lorem says he's frustrated because South Sudan's farmers should be able to produce enough food to feed their communities. However, due to the conflict and the lack of modern farming method, it's not possible at this time.
The main motivation is that if I could start a business that would provide opportunity for more people, then hopefully I'm thinking it would give me a chance to hopefully employ them and give them a chance to actually do something meaningful, not necessarily waiting for a handout.
Lorem plans to focus his attention on Kenya for now. According to Lorem, there are millions of small-scale farmers in Kenya who engage in subsistence farming using techniques that are mostly outdated. Philemon Rono is Lorem's business partner and co-founder of Tanuru Farms. He is from Kenya, and he says the old traditional way of farming has led to low productivity and forces communities to import massive quantities of fruits, vegetables, and meat.
If we are importing, why can't we try to cut that down by producing our local raw materials? That will help us to, you know, create employment, increase profitability for farmers who are doing agricultural production. And at the same time, we'll be helping Kenya to improve its balance of trade.
Rono says they'll start the business by focusing on three crops.
Right now, we are dealing with soybeans, sunflower, and canola. After our research, we found out that we import most of these crops, yet Kenya is perfectly fit to be able to meet the demand.
Lorem and Rono are both very optimistic about the future of Tanuru Farms. Lorem believes that if Tanuru Farms can turn a profit within a few years in Kenya, they can expand the business to South Sudan, where new businesses are desperately needed. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Top leaders in Burundi appear to be digging in despite growing international pressure and concern over the Central African nation's political crisis. Seeking to mediate an end to the crisis, which has sparked often violent street protests, the United States named Senegalese diplomat Abdoulaye Batali as special envoy to the Great Lakes region, replacing Saïd Djinnit of Algeria. The government of Burundi rejected the appointment, saying that a UN report critical of Burundi's June 29th parliamentary elections was biased and unfair. Tensions with the international community could be exacerbated as Burundi heads into the July 15th presidential election. President Pierre Nkurunziza remains intent to run for a third term, despite a planned boycott by major opposition parties and a lack of international observers to monitor the vote. The president's continued disregard for the Arusha Agreement and its term limit provisions has resulted in dozens of deaths and an exodus of over 144,000 Burundians to neighboring countries. The economy is in free fall, causing millions to suffer. The decision to proceed with last month's parliamentary vote, despite the complete absence of the necessary conditions for credible elections, further exacerbated an already dire situation. The United States joins with the African Union, the United Nations, and other regional bodies and leaders in urging President Nkurunziza to place his nation's welfare above his own political ambitions and participate in dialogue with the opposition and civil society to identify a peaceful solution to this deepening crisis. This presidential vote should be delayed until conditions are in place for free, fair, and peaceful elections. Due to the precarious political and security situation there, and the government's unwillingness to engage in good-faith efforts to negotiate a solution, the United States has suspended several security assistance programs on which it has cooperated with Burundi. In response to abuses committed by police during the political protests, we are suspending all International Law Enforcement Academy and anti-terrorism assistance training for Burundian law enforcement agencies. We have also suspended upcoming training for the Burundian military under the Department of Defense's Section 1206 Train and Equip Program, as well as training and assistance under the Africa Military Education Program. Finally, during our upcoming review of Burundi's eligibility for the trade preferences available to it under the African Growth and Opportunity Act, we will consider ongoing violence and instability and the government of Burundi's lack of respect for the rule of law in determining its eligibility for continuing these important trade preferences.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, Please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.